You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. I'd like to remind you of my holiday screenwriting workshop happening December 22nd through January 2nd, online with Zoom meetings, daily work, and daily feedback. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to register for this workshop. What do writers fear most? The blank page. How to start a story. How to get into a story. Yes, you have a great idea. Now write it down. Keep writing. It becomes less great on the page, but worry not. If you've been a longtime listener to Drinks with Tony, you know that almost every author I've interviewed over the decades faces the exact same fear. We just know that that fear is there and we know how to work through it. Watching a film or reading a suspenseful book is watching a puzzle and trying to figure out what happens next. If a character faces conflict, we want to know how that character is going to get out of the conflict. All stories are puzzles. So how do we as writers create the puzzle when it's a blank page? Well, that's where I'll guide you and your fellow students through my holiday screenwriting workshop. We'll set aside about 2 hours a day to go from idea to a full-fledged outline of your screenplay. It works, it's fun, it's a little scary, but have no fear, it's never not scary. We just learn to live with it as authors and as screenwriters. Are you ready to take the challenge? Go to drinkswithtony.com to register for the Screenplay Holiday Workshop. That's drinkswithtony.com. Register early for a discount and be ready December 22nd to produce some pages. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Carol Tyler, and you are listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Carol Tyler. She's the author of The Ephemerata, Shaping the Exquisite Nature of Grief. It's a graphic memoir. Carol, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, too. So you're in Cincinnati right now.
Home of the Cincinnati Reds, you bet.
Well, earlier you said the Bengals, so I think you're more of a football lady. Is that a correct assumption?
Joe Burrow.
What's that?
I'm one of those. I love Joe Burrow. He's hot.
Is he? Oh, I love that. Yeah, and unfortunately, like I was having this conversation with someone talking about when can you pick your home team, because like sometimes I feel like I hate being a Giants fan, San Francisco Giants, but at the same time, it's the only thing I'll ever know. And whenever I talk about the Giants, I say we, like I have a, like, and my friends say we and us, and we need to do this. Like we personally are attached to it. And I think it's a very abusive relationship. So it's sporting and what we connect to. Yeah, if you went because they're attractive, I like that. That makes so much more sense many levels.
He's hot. He's beyond, it's, you know, most beautiful man in the world or something. But talk about team loyalty. So I was a Chicago Cubs fan, of course, because I was raised on Addison Street in Chicago, and that way was Riverview, and that way was Cubs Park, Wrigley Field. And so, of course, I grew up a Cubs fan, and when I lived in San Francisco, I never bonded with the Giants, with anything out there sports. I was there for art reasons. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when I came to Cincinnati, one of the things was, I did pick it out on a map that we can talk about later, but one of the things that I did was think, oh, it's got a Major League Baseball team, but it was Pete Rose's. Ugh. And why I had this thing against Pete Rose was that when Chicago was in contention, the Cubs, were in contention to win like a pennant in 1969. I was one of those bleacher bums.
Uh-huh.
And there was this one game. It was like, you know, there's always that game that either you're going to go this way or that way, momentum wise. So this was one of those games that somebody hit the ball over there, Pete Rose. It was impossible, but he made this diving catch. And then to the Chicago fans, he was going, because it was an out. And that meant we were out. But, you know, it ended up that we did not get the pennant or anything that year. And so it's like, I always hate you, Pete Rose. But then I went to college in Tennessee. And because I was such a spaz loving baseball, I thought they had a replay of the Big Red Machine. There was like a, back then you'd have to go to the student union to watch a documentary.
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to see that. I think the Big Red, even though I hate Pete Rose, this is what I said back then. I want to go watch about the Big Red Machine. So I didn't tell any of my cool hipster art friends, but I went to watch this video of the Big Red Machine. So when I moved here, it was like, well, I'm here now. And this is the home of the Big Red Machine. I kind of missed that, but I'm here and I like the new stadium. And then I sort of started becoming a Reds fan. And then at a certain point, I had to say, am I a Reds fan or am I still a Cubs fan? I wasn't really a Cubs fan. So at a certain point, I went, I am a Reds fan.
You switched teams.
I switched teams. It was about, just before the pandemic. It was the year that they had Eugenio Suarez. In fact, I have a scar on my hand right here.
Uh-huh.
I call it my Suarez.
Okay.
Because I was building a set of shelves out at the farm and I had this power drill, the impact drill.
Uh-huh.
And I was having to, with one arm, hold this thing up and move this thing. And I was trying to make it that one thing that would get the whole project started in the drill, just as it said on the radio, Eugenio Suarez hit a double or something. It just went right into my, I said, oh my God, I've got a Suarez.
That is rad. So
there it is. I still have a scar from that.
Yeah.
The drill went right through my hand. Pfft. He hit a double.
And then do you have to drill your hand when you're in contention again? And it worked last time. Let's see if it'll work again.
No, it's just like, I guess I got my battle scar here.
Yeah.
I had my bobbleheads that year and all that. I mean, I was nuts that year. I had what's that guy's name? He made history in Reds history until he got a groin injury. Anyway, I got his bobblehead. They're just out at the farm.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I want to visit Cincinnati so bad. And the Giants, because I follow the Giants, when they play there, the field looks gorgeous. And I'm just like, oh my God, I want to go there so bad.
Yeah,
just like to visit the ballpark and also just to see like Cincinnati people. And it's just,
Cincinnati people, we're here. We're all over the place. Cincinnatians, who are we?
We got to talk about how you decided on Cincinnati, because the length of your research is astonishing. Exactly what happened for you to go, you know what, this is Cincinnati, and after all this research and everything I've done, what was that research?
There was no research.
What?
Here's what happened. It's common knowledge that my husband had an affair in 1997 after 11 or so years of marriage. And it got me messed up because he kept saying, I love you, but I love her too. And it was, you know, one of those
oof
things. And I thought I could, you know, he wasn't sure, but so I finally said, I got to get out of here. I can't live with your indecision. You're either in this marriage or you're not. And I had to go somewhere. I was a wreck. I couldn't get up off the floor. And so I went to the library and I said, I went to the library. I think you couldn't get internet access or something. I was at the library. And there was a map of the United States. And I said, I have to relocate. I'm going to move to when I close my eyes. And I said, Cincinnati, Ohio, here I come.
Wow.
The only association I had with it is that I had driven through from Tennessee to New York once. I had driven through Cincinnati. And so I sold everything I owned and had that $1,000 and I tucked it right here in my waist pocket place and sent my kid on to her grandparents up in New York. And I sold everything. I had a bag of clothes. I was on the train blubbering. And came here. You know, I had to go to New York first to pick up the kid. Long story, but I'll just get right to it. I arrived, the train doesn't really come here, so I'd take a little bus connector from Cleveland. And I was such a wreck. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I arrived here and the lady, I had an address of where I could stay at a convent. They were renting out rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lady delivering pizzas gave me a ride out there because I said, can you tell me how I can get to Mount St. Joseph?
Yeah.
She drove me out there, and every day I took a bus into the city, into the different neighborhoods, because I had to find a place. It's like, I either stay here, or what am I going to do? I can't live out there with that drama going on with him and that lady.
I'm not doing that.
And so, and then kid happened to get the kid into school and everything. So I took these daily forays into town, and I'd get on the bus. I'd say, how do I get to Oakley? And the driver would say, just get on the bus. I'll tell you when to get on. Everybody was so nice to me.
Wow.
Another driver said, listen, if you don't find an apartment, you can go down here to this office. Office of Housing, blah, blah, blah. They'll put you up until you get on your feet. I was just astounded at how people, this place opened up there quietly, individually. People did such wonderful things for me. And then my kid got into the school that I wanted to get into, the arts magnet school. That's what she had been in at home and since Sacramento. And it just kind of worked. And then I became this booster because my kid was like, I don't like to be here. And she was a mess. I was like, no, come on, we're going to go down and see the fireworks. There was always something going on every weekend. Every time you turn around, Cincinnati had a beer festival or they had this or that. So in order to keep from being sad over that whole episode, first of all, I made sure I had an apartment that was on a bus line. Because having grown up in Chicago, I remembered that it could snow really bad and they'd keep this one main artery open. So I got an apartment that overlooked the square that had that bus routes. I thought, I can always get on the bus and get out of here if there's a problem.
Yeah.
And then it was also on the bus line to her school in case my car didn't arrive. I had to get my car shipped, my 64 Chevy. And this is 1997. That was the only car I had.
Yeah, yeah. That's a car you can fix. Like back in the day, you can actually fix them.
I know that. And my dad hotwired it for me so you didn't have to use a key. Uh-huh. So I never worry about it being stolen because the people today wouldn't know they wouldn't know anything about jacking a car.
Yeah.
So there it was, the old 64 Chevy. I had that. Anyway, I got all that and I became this booster, and going down to the ballpark was part of that, trying to get my kid, va va voom, let's go, Cincinnati, yeah, woo, woo. Okay.
When you're there on your scouting, I just need to get out trip, and you're not, and your daughter's not with you, and as you're doing this, right? So you're on your own, trying to put something together. I've been through a divorce where I found out that my ex-wife was having an affair, and she also tried to like destroy me. There was so many layers to it that I was just like,
it's terrible. It's the most excruciating thing to have to go through. It's like passing a kidney stone. You know, it's painful. You know, it's happening. You're aware. You have every emotion under the sun to have to reorder your whole life. And what about our friends? I mean, the layering of it, the Well, you said 6 years ago that you loved me, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You swore up and down we were going to be together forever.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's such a betrayal. But you are in, you I think it's so brave that you are in another city and alone. I mean, essentially, I was just telling friends, hi, I'm on suicide watch. Like, you need to, like, I just, my whole life just flipped upside down, and I need help. And it was like, let's just make sure Tony stays alive for the next, year. And then I ended up just checking myself into a hospital to get the tools I needed. But it's so the bravery of just going to another city and just doing that alone. And it's almost like, do you feel like you put yourself in that situation so you can make yourself strong again immediately? Like almost like diving into ice cold water just so your body can like acclimate. And do you think that's part of your how you healed?
It's hard to say because I think back on how and why I've done things. I come from, both of my brothers were Olympic athletes and they were in bobsledding.
Yeah.
And my one brother was a football player and, they were alpha male. They still are alive, but the whole attitude in our world was that they took risks because they did like a very scary sport.
Yeah.
And there are men, they're going to lift this thing or move this thing. And I was the artist, which seemed reticent. But then I realized through this whole episode that I am also a risk taker, but my risks are not jumping off a bungee cord or off of a thing. My risks were emotional and personal. In other words, the risk I took to come here to Cincinnati was, if I don't do something, what am I going to, what? I just felt like I had to do the equivalent of maybe bungee jumping off of a tall bridge or something. I had to just, and I have a, when you have a kid, I had a little kid who, 12 years old, who had to, I was motivated because I did not want her to get in. I didn't want to do the Tuesday, Thursday, you go with them.
Right.
You go with the guy who cheated and the lady who agreed to that. You go with them. No, I'm not raising you to go be, I didn't want to take her away from her dad, but they were trying to, the whole thing was like trying to normalize something that to me was like nuts.
Yeah.
And I know that there are people who bite the bullet. They work it out with their exes and all that kind of stuff. But part of me said, I would rather model being strong and moving forward than caving in to the demands of people I did not respect anymore.
Yeah.
And then once I got here, so coming here to a new town, I don't know. I've always done risky things that way, like I said, emotionally risky things. I'm the person who will step forward and say something, or like if people are stepping over something that's wrong, I'll say, we got to fix this, or that ain't right, I'll speak up. I just don't have fear that way. I've always been kind of out there, up front.
And how beautiful that you just pointed to a map and then the city embraced you, it sounds like.
Yeah, the people were nice. And here I'm in the Midwest. I had come from Sacramento. I'd spent almost 20 years out there.
Okay.
In San Francisco, and we were in Sacramento for a while. And so, but I was born and raised in Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
So I know about the Midwestern values and, the weather and stuff like that. So all of that was familiar, but yet I didn't want to go back to Chicago. It was time to go. It's like, boy, I'm glad I didn't pick Chicago on the map because I didn't want to, you can't go home again, they say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You really
Yeah.
can't go back to the town where a big life part of your life unfolded and you moved along.
Yeah.
I've moved away from a lot of places for various reasons.
Yeah.
You know, I took a risk when I reached for the Big Apple, and it worked out. I was in Tennessee. I'd been married there, and I had to decide that when I caught him cheating, it was like, what is with this? What do people do this? We were fine. No,
Right.
he's a liar. I'm leaving. It's not
I
me.
don't understand that type of lying and betrayal, because it's just like, if something's not working out, then talk about it and just be
Just
up
tell
front.
me. I'm out
Yeah,
of here.
it's this dance of like, oh, I'm gonna, it's almost like they get high off of being
Yeah,
secretive,
secretive.
and it's so pathological, and it's kind of mind-blowing.
I'm sorry
So,
that happened to you, but it does screw with your head because
yeah.
you think you have suspicions, things don't seem right. And
Well, I
then the
didn't
world looks
have,
at
I wasn't that smart.
oh,
I had no suspicions. I was in denial.
you were trusting, but and that's worse because you were blindsided.
Completely, yeah. I didn't even know what was going on, and then all of a sudden there was money being moved around, and I don't want to go into it too much, but it was just like, it was just, I'm gonna blow up your life, and you're never going to see me again. You don't even know what I'm doing, kind of thing. So it was like, it was a planned thing, and it was also crazy because it was right when my writing career just started to go. And it was just like everything was converging, which scares me when I it's something that I need to get over, where I get scared when I have something about to be released or something that's about to get me to the next step, because that betrayal thing in the back of my head is
Always there.
there. And it's just like,
It's always there.
but it's just at this point, it's like, who's gonna betray me? Wait, let's go, man, let's go. So it's funny.
It's a primal, it goes into your like a part of your limbic brain, the
Yeah.
reptilian. Because when I whenever I have a nightmare, about once every 2 or 3 months, I have a very disturbing dream, and it's always the same.
Oh, really?
It always has to do with him finding out that he's not gonna doesn't want to be with me,
Yeah.
which I've gone to therapy about. I've done all kinds of stuff. I can't figure out why I have that because I didn't have my parents were all uber faithful to each other. You know, I didn't have a history of that in the family. And the thing that bothers me about it is when you get cheated on, people will always think, well, maybe she wasn't good enough for him, or maybe she didn't service him enough, or maybe she just, it's like, shut up. None of that is true. Don't look at me.
Right,
It wasn't
exactly.
my character. And like, why did it happen to me twice? In fact, it happened with three major relationships that guys,
Wow.
I think guys just feel like they got licensed from Bob Dylan to go ahead and be a Rolling Stone. That was part of like our generation manhood. You just meet a chick, and rock and roll says, you know, love the one you're with. And I'm
Yeah.
not like some kind of Republican Karen here,
Yeah. You're
you
not
know, who's gonna.
grabbing baseballs out of people's hand out of
Oh.
kids' hands.
No.
What is it? What are they calling her? The Philly Karen?
Philly Karen. Philly Karen.
Oh
No.
man, what a thing to get famous for. That I'm just I, it's yeah. Anyway, but back to so I mean, how do you feel now? Do you feel trusting? I mean, what do you do when it's hit you three times? Do you feel trusting to go into another relationship again, or are you just kind of like, you know what? I got my own thing going. Let's just be me and alone, and I'm the risk taker, and I'll put all my risk in this bag. How does that work?
Well, Justin and I reconciled for the sake of the child, but it turned out that we really enjoyed each other's company after. I always enjoyed his company.
Oh,
but cool. He had to go through something. Something was going on with him. He had his brother died, a couple other things. And so midlife crisis, I don't know. And so I always was on board with him. He didn't see himself. So I had to, as my sister told me, sometimes you have to hold the energy for people until they're ready to understand what that means, to be present for yourself. And he got distracted because he also had OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And once he would get locked in on something, he'd have to pursue it. You'd have to go there. I don't care if it was a JFK conspiracy or this lady. So his obsessions, which were a part of him, also drove his behavior. So I found all that out, figured all that out, because it turned out that after he left, my daughter went bonkers when she got to Cincinnati. Where's Dad? How come he's not here? Why are we in this town? I don't like this. I'm like, oh, I'm sick. I'm choking myself. She was took it back. And so I took her to Children's Hospital. We ended up spending 2 years over there going through this, that, and the other thing till they, because she was suicidal. She was a mess.
Which is scary and for a parent, because you're just like, oh.
Yeah, I'd say, Justin, get your ass over here. Our kid is in trouble. I don't, you can tell her to just back down for a minute and be a parent.
Yeah.
That's the way I was talking to him at first. And then I realized, I mean, I knew he really, truly had fallen for her, but he had also fallen into reality about, you know, the grass isn't really that greener.
Yes.
You know, the troubles follow you wherever you go. Yourself is always there.
Yeah.
So to pin all of his problems, looks, I'm the reason why he was miserable. It turned out, this wasn't why he was miserable. It was because of his own, wherever he was at the time. And I knew that. And I knew for the sake of our kid, I did want him in my life. I did want to patch things back up. I just wanted the whole episode to go away, you know, and have him around. Because, you know, I'm a fan. I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
Julia, you know, then Julia had OCD. So those two bonded really tight. Because she had what he had, and he went through it and did his book, Binky Brown. I'm sure you've heard of Binky Brown Meets Holy Virgin Mary.
What's that?
It is, okay, probably back up and tell you who Justin is. Justin is considered the father of the autobiographical comic.
Oh, really?
He wrote, in 1972, he wrote Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary. He wrote and drew it as a compulsion when he lived in San Francisco on Abbey Street.
On what street?
It had never been done before. Abbey.
Abbey.
Right by Mission Dolores.
Okay.
What he did was, he had OCD, serious, severe OCD, growing up as a rich kid in Catholic in Chicago, Chicago suburb. But back then, they didn't have a diagnosis. You just were considered to have a neurosis of some sort. And his was involved with, or it was wrapped up in troubles with Catholicism. He thought he had was responsible for Christ's crucifixion, and that any impure thought he had, they were all tied with the Virgin Mary, and he had his hands and feet, all the digits on his body turned into phalluses. And so he had to watch how he would point his fingers and toes, because he might inadvertently harm somebody.
Yeah.
Or do something terrible to the Virgin, and then that would be more reasons that would prove that he had committed sins against Christ and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, to be a boy and have that and have to carry that around, and yet he couldn't be normal, or he couldn't tell anybody because they yeah. it didn't exist in the 50s and 60s. Mental yeah. illness. Well, yeah. I don't know. So he had to normalize, like he'd have to figure out workarounds to appear normal. One of them was being a tough guy. One of them was to super smart. Art. He really got into art. He just really focused attention. And so when in 72, when he was in San Francisco, he was born in 1945. So I don't know what year that, how old he would have been. But he just, it just came out of this Binky Brown comic where he told about how the symptoms came on and where it led and how he had to try to deal with it in order to get on with his life. So I saw that comic in 1982 when I was at Syracuse and I went, okay, let's make the little cartoon symbols for cussing.
Holy yeah.
This guy is telling it like it is. I can't believe this. It was so out there, so blatant, so crude and raw and intense. It blew my head off. I thought, I gotta meet this guy, because at the time I was doing kind of personal paintings, but they were a little bit more vague. I didn't come right out and say things, you know. Yeah. The times, the way things were back then. So in 82, I flew out to visit a friend, but then I also wanted to look up this guy, Justin Green. And immediate sparks.
Huh.
And he had taken up sign painting to pay the bills because he had a kid.
Uh-huh.
And I went on a sign job with him on our first date. And then on our first date...
Take your potential lover to work day?
Take your what?
Take your potential lover to work day? Is that what it was called?
Oh, when you're self-employed, you're a seat-of-the-pants guy out on the streets of San Francisco with your sign kit. You got to get such X amount done before the fog rolls in.
So you met him in San Francisco?
I went out there mm-hmm. to see a friend.
Wow.
And then he had said, well, let's have lunch. So we went to lunch somewhere around Tommy's joint because that's the job yeah. he was doing. He painted the graphics on Tommy's
joint. No way. Oh, the ones that are still there? Because I don't think they've changed them.
I think they've been altered a little bit. I've looked at it recently. There's some of Justin's marks still there. Some yeah. of my marks. I helped that day on it.
Wow. I lived a block away from it. That was the my last 3 years in San Francisco, I lived on Polk and Geary.
Tommy's. That was our first. Yeah. That was our first job together. But we went to the sandwich place. I told you about living on Addison Street and going to the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was sitting there with him, I knew his comic. I read his comic. I was a big fan, you know. I just kept looking at him. He was looking at me, and I said, "You look familiar." I don't know why. "You're from Chicago." "But we didn't go to the same high schools." He said, "No, we didn't." And then I said, "What did you do in Chicago?" He said, "Well, I left in, you know, he lived in Highland Park, which is a wealthy suburb north of Chicago." And we talked around that. Then he said he went back in 1968 in the summer and he drove a bus. I went, "What route did you drive?" And he said, "I drove the 151. It went down to Addison Street." I said, "Really?" Because when I was nine, we lived in the city, but then we moved way out to Fox Lake. My dad wanted us to have access to water. It was great. We had a boat. It was a wonderful, wonderful teenage years out there at the lakes.
And this is in Illinois?
But we would drive in, and I was Little League coach of my little brother's team. We would drive in and park in our old neighborhood and then catch the bus and go in so we didn't have to pay parking over at Wrigley Field.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "You drove the 151? And then he looked at me and he said to me, "You got on my bus." I said, "And you're the driver." I remembered him.
Wow.
I remember getting on a bus. All the Chicago bus drivers back then were these kind of Polish guys, overweight. Yeah. "Come on, lady, get on the bus." You know.
Yeah.
Right. And he was, Madam, step on, he was using great English to invite me onto the bus with my brother and told me where, it'd be nice to sit there, blah, blah, blah. He would let me know. There was one other lady on the bus, and it was me and my brother. And I remembered him. It was so remarkable because he was attractive, adorably attractive, and kind, unlike every other Chicago bus driver I ever encountered. And then in San Francisco, from 1968, 1982, all that time later, we remembered each other in the restaurant. So it was like DESTINY. It was written all over it.
Do you ever think this? I love these types of things. Do you ever like go back to yourself getting on the bus when you're going to Wrigley Field and think like if that kid knew that that kid was going to have a child with that bus driver, just it would almost be like a film. It's like the first time it's like, oh, that guy is kind. I'll have a child with him 12 years from now. Is that
Well, when I met him, when he came to the house, it was on Church Street. And I was living there with a bunch of women. Half of them were lesbians, but that's a good thing. I love being around women.
Well, wait, there
But
were that the I don't know, was the Lexington Club open then? Because that was
I
like
don't know.
that was the big
I was there to I ended up working at the Fab Mab.
Oh, no way. Oh, you must have seen like every punk band ever.
I did.
Wow.
I was a cocktail waitress or beer waitress,
No way. How
shoving
many
beer
years did
bottles.
you work there?
Oh no, it was just for the summer.
Okay. But that's
Yeah.
still a lot. That's still a lot of bands to see one summer.
Yep. I let I met I let I met what was his name? I met all those people, and yeah, the Toiling Midgets were the band that summer.
Oh, they're so good. I just found a Toiling Midgets vinyl at Amoeba, and when I brought it up to the counter, I think the lady was offended by the name of the band. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. I'm a San Franciscan. You guys got this in the sales section. You don't understand what this is.
No, I don't know. And Translator was popular that summer.
Yeah, Translator came on Drinks with Tony
Oh,
about 20 years ago.
they
I don't remember why we connected, but I used to have a band on the second hour and an author on the first hour. And so one day I like Translator's publicist got in touch with me and I'm like, they're like, do you want to? And I'm like, are you kidding me? Yes. Like I grew up with those guys. Yeah. 'Cause she's everywhere that I'm
I
not.
saw
Get
you.
down on the
Avenues.
avenue.
That was a good
Wow.
summer.
Toiling Midgets, Translator, who else comes to mind?
I was there to just live there, and when I met him, we had that date, and that turned into like we were both but he was kind of ending a relationship with this woman he lived with, and he had this kid, and he was busy all the time, and he was living with Spain, the cartoonist Spain. So I didn't know what to make of it because I fell for him immediately, and he told me he loved me, but he couldn't move the ball forward because he was so mired in his problems and, excuse me, things going on at the time. So I told him I had an art show coming up. I needed a portrait painted. I was leaving on, he said, when are you leaving? I said, August 11th or something like that. Oh gosh, oh, I'm sorry. I really like you, but I can't seem to work you into my life. And then, of course, on August 8th on Sunday, he's come over. Come on over. We had a great day together. I mean, he was the guy on our very first date when we were in San Francisco. We went to lunch, we painted the sign, and then before it was time to leave, I said, I don't want this day to end. And he said, come on, we went in a guitar store. He picks a guitar up off the wall and he starts playing like Robert Johnson songs
Wow.
perfectly.
Hunk. Like immediate, like I'm the hunk vibe
You got me.
right
I was
there.
so there, and I tried all summer flirting, doing everything I could, and then he waited till I was leaving town to say, why don't you come over today? My roommate's gone. And then that episode or that time of being together on that Sunday, having a very intimate exchange, hit us both strongly. I went back to New York. I was with this guy who ended up being a big LA painter, and he was on Peavy's show. I got to get my charger. Hold on.
Sure, sure.
The phone is running on a battery steam. No, I was with Wayne White. You know this guy?
I don't, no.
Okay, good. Let's not talk about that.
Okay,
we don't have to talk about that. Yeah. I was with a guy, and I had to deal with him, but at the same time, I had these just great feelings about Justin. I could not make the feelings stop. Okay, it's got to be like this for a while. Sorry to the viewers. You'll have to look at.
That's fine. That's fine. We'll just do this. Go ahead. I just, for those of you listening on the radio, I'm putting my head sideways.
Why do I have a bungee cord? I'll just hold it for a while. We corresponded for like a year.
And I was still in graduate school. You were in New York and he's in San Francisco.
Well, I was in Syracuse, but then I went to New York.
Okay.
And I got to, you know, I was really doing the New York art girl thing. I had art shows, you know, I was meeting all the big art people.
Where did you live in New York?
The Lower East Side.
Yeah, where everyone lived in those days. That was the spot, right? Yeah.
Step over the junkie to get into the place where you want to have a bowl of the Odessa.
Yeah.
You know, get something to eat. And, you know, I would have a... I was starting to make my paintings into sequence, which was part of the whole meeting Justin and all of that. I was turning sequential.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those people that would do things in New York City, like make copies. This was hot back then. I made copies of my hair and I put them on telephone poles.
Uh-huh.
You know, punker kind of weird stuff. That was the scene back then. And I carried this patent leather purse around. I kept a staple gun and I'd make little sequential paintings and I would put them up around town.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't get any good art. And it was hard to get a gallery exhibit and stuff like that. So one
that was time, that was the original Instagram.
Yeah.
You know,
we did what we had to do back then.
Yeah. So but it's beautiful. I miss those times of, you know, putting things on foam poles of upcoming events and all that stuff.
Making zines, you know.
I was making zines all the time you become friends with friends who have like corporate jobs, or even when I did temp work, I'll work overtime. And then I would just be burning their copy machine, making my little zines and then going to another place to staple them together. Yeah.
That's right. That was the vibe. We were all in that vibe. But also one time I thought, somebody invites, let's go to Danceteria. Why? Oh, because Art Spiegelman's having a show there on the second or third floor of Danceteria. It was like this stacked, I don't know if you know about it, a stacked building. And you had music on one or two floors and there was like a gallery thing or whatever.
Yeah.
So my official first art show in New York, I took my staple gun and on the hallway, there was nothing in the hallway on the way to the bathroom. So I had my artwork in the hallway that I kept in my patent leather purse so I carried around. But I'm playing down there on the second floor was this new hot musician called Madonna.
Oh my God. Keep going. I got to tell you, I was thinking of the movie Desperately Seeking Susan right now. And I'll tell you why in a few minutes, but go ahead.
No, that was the vibe. That was the scene. Yeah. It was dirty. Yes. That was her friend. And I was wearing, I had the look. I had my hair kind of bleached and punked out and all that kind of stuff. And I wore socks. You wore anklets with your kitten heels, your little shoes.
Yeah.
Your little high heels. And Justin's brother worked at Hammer Galleries on 54th Street and Park. And I would just go up there and looked there, and yeah, I was inspired. You're downtown. Billy Joel's song, Downtown Girl,
yeah.
Uptown Girl, and all that stuff. I was definitely downtown. But I would go up there to that avenue around the plaza because the Beatles had been there and I was a Beatle fan.
Yeah.
And just the magic of horse-drawn carriages and the jewelry in the window, you know, just beautiful up there. So
Yeah.
different than the crap down on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went up there. I got the courage together once and I went into that gallery to meet Justin's brother, Gus, Keith. And right away, he called Justin later. He said, "What are you doing with this? She's wearing socks with her high heels. What kind of girl is that?"
You
That
got
was the
judged.
look.
So you got judged on 54th.
Yeah. But that was the look. That was what you saw Madonna. Everybody
So
downtown.
did so it was did you watch Madonna's show? Were you able to see her do her show?
Yeah, but it didn't. It was more of the same. That was the
Yeah.
life in New York. You'd see stuff like that. Oh, you know, she wasn't big yet.
Yeah.
She was just starting. You could
Yeah.
feel her yearning for fame. You could feel it was, you know, the
Yeah.
thing then was Michael Jackson.
Yes. So that was like
Took a long time.
1983, 1984 kind of. So
I was
I.
there. I was in and out of New York. I was at Syracuse from 81 to 83,
Uh-huh.
but when you go to Syracuse University, you spend half your time in New York City. That's just the thing you do as an art student. So I had lots of friends who had apartments there. You could go and spend the day. You could fly for $20. They had an airline that you could fly for $20 to spend. So I'm going to fly to New York tomorrow because I want to see the Philip Guston show, stuff
Yeah.
like that.
Oh, it's so cool.
So, yeah. I need to go to the Whitney. I'm going to fly to New York. So for $20, you could go do the city and go back home at night. And then, you know, I moved down there. But then, and it was in the summer of 82 in graduate school that I thought, I was down at the Lower East Side apartment. I thought, I'm not going to spend the summer in this cramped old place. I'm going out to see Mary, my old roommate from undergraduate school in San Francisco. And while I'm at it, I'm going to look up that Justin. So
Yeah.
that's how that happened. And then
And
after
then
Justin
summer in
said,
San Francisco is great because it's foggy if you're in the right neighborhood.
I didn't know that. You know, let's go swimming. No, no, no. And, you know, I quickly figured out you got to kind of dress like any particular March day in New York City. So that
Yeah.
was fine. I was
Yeah,
cool with
yeah.
that.
So regarding the book, the exquisite nature shaping grief, what who is this book like? What's this book about actually? Is what I'm asking is what is the grief that you're hitting? Are you hitting all grief or are you hitting a specific grief?
Well, a bunch of people that I've been, I ended up after I got with Justin, I ended up moving out to San Francisco and my career was the comics that I made were always about people that I knew. So it'd be like my parents or, you know, my life with Justin or something like that. So it was referenced on my family. And then what happened was after I moved here, remember, I picked it on the map and
Yeah.
came here. Well, it turned out that my sister and my mom and dad lived about 2 hours away. And so I hadn't seen them for decades, but suddenly I could see them every other weekend, you know. So that was fun. Well, they all died. They all got sick and died.
Yeah.
But before that, I'd spent a decade helping my sister take care of my parents, who lived to be in their mid-90s.
Wow.
And
Yeah.
then she died at 65, which was shocking.
Oh, wow.
Because she was the woman who swam laps at the pool and made sure she ate good and didn't do, you know, I'm not going to eat the ice cream because it's full of fat, it's full of sugar. And she did everything right.
Uh-huh.
She got caught. Anyway.
And what happened to her? What it was, I mean,
ovarian cancer, boom, just like that. She kept saying, "Oh man, something. Oh,
yeah,
funny here." And I'd
they
say, "Oh,
found it.
you need to eat yogurt, honey. You're not drinking enough water. You know, Oh, but it just feels weird. And
Oof.
it went on for a couple years, and then she just couldn't take it anymore. And she had an autistic, her daughter was autistic, and her husband had Alzheimer's and
Yeah,
was
oh
diabetic.
wow.
She was caring for all of these people.
Yeah.
She finally drove herself to the emergency room, and they opened her up, and it was like, she's toast. Stage four, they
Wow. Oh
said.
my God. That's like the worst. That's like the, I don't know if you, like Gilda Radner, I had that same thing where they
It's
no one
bad.
they don't diagnose they no one diagnosed
Nope.
her until it
There's
was
no,
like
there's
you're
really,
terminal.
because
Yeah.
women have, you talked about pain tolerance, women have vague symptoms. There's always something going on down there,
Yeah.
cramping or bleeding. That's just, oh, it's just never ending.
Yeah.
So it's hard to diagnose.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll work on it. But so anyway, when she passed away, my mom and dad passed away. It just was living in a world that didn't, my parents, I had the luxury of having them through my 60s,
Yeah.
50s,
Yeah.
for sure. 60s. And I liked them, but my parents were, it was a complicated relationship because they kept me at a distance because they said kids need to get on their own. But I was attracted to them as I was in my dad. I loved him because he, I realized now he was extreme. They both were extremely creative, amazing, innovative, funny, but they weren't emotionally needy on me. And they did kind of cut me off. I talk about that in this book I wrote called Soldier's Heart.
Okay.
So I've been writing about all of this, about them and all of this in this book called Soldier's Heart, which was about my dad was one of those guys who, when he was hit his 80s, he started having weird flashbacks about World War II. And
Oh, he served in World War II?
he was in the Bulge and stuff like that. And then
Wow.
I started writing about it, I started asking questions, and it wasn't adding up. So that became an interesting book that I wrote about trying to get to the bottom of what the heck was his problem. It turned out he had PTSD, and he was never diagnosed, which is why he was kind of crabby and shitty when I was growing up. But yet he would kick back a few on Friday with his friends and be so jolly. And, my mom, after he came back from the war, happy family till my sister died, their firstborn.
Wow.
So my mom wore the scars of that and didn't talk about it until she was in her 70s and told me about it in 1994. And I wrote a story about that, which ended up on the list of the top 100 comics of the 20th century, because the significance of the Hannah story was that it made, in comics, like Justin did the first autobiographical, really go there comics. And I ended up doing something similar, but not really, with the Hannah story, which went into the depth of my sister's. Because when I did the research, what we all thought growing up, because we weren't allowed to talk about it, was that she had some kind of burns and died. But what I came to find out in talking to her when she finally started to open up was that the hospital screwed up.
Oof.
She choked in her sleep in the middle of the night. It was not discovered till the next day. When my parents went in to pick her up the next day, they said, Anne Marie Tyler, let's see, we have her. She's listed as deceased. And they were like, we're gonna pick up our daughter.
And
No.
how old was she?
Two and a half.
Oof. This it's I'm, my mind is blown. Her name is Carol Tyler. The book is The Ephemerata, Shaping the Exquisite Nature of Grief. Carol, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay. Fun to be here. Thank you so much.
Great and cut. Yeah, that was just all so good. I mean, Carol Tyler on Drinks with Tony. What a fun interview. We go for another 20 minutes of chatting because it was so much fun that I couldn't stop recording. So if you'd like to listen to the rest of the interview, it's online at drinkswithtony.com or wherever you receive your podcasts. Also remember, registration is open for the holiday screenplay workshop, where I'll guide you through from idea to completed detailed outline in 2 weeks, hitting every major story beat. That link is at drinkswithtony.com to register. You'll learn how every film has about 15 story beats, and not only will you write yours and expand from there, but you will see from now until the end of time every beat in every film and how it's covered. It'll kind of ruin all film for you, which is fun. Then we get to see it in a different way. Hey, so start your screenplay before 2025 ends and you let another year go by. It's the holiday screenplay workshop. Go to drinkswithtony.com to register. Join me for 2 weeks, December 22nd through January 2nd. All the info and registration is at drinkswithtony.com. I'll see you next week. Hey, thanks for listening.
Of the sky. by Weavers being made martyr. Spawn the zodiacal hell of this cataclysm, garland of growls, heavenly round.